We will proceed then to the fourth case on the morning docket, which is Phelan versus Cook County, case number 04-3991. Mr. Holman.
Good morning. Brian Holman on behalf of the plaintiff appellate, Laura Phelan. When Laura Phelan was terminated from her position at Cook County Hospital, she had a duty under Title VII to mitigate her damages. That's exactly what she did. She went out, she retained the services of counsel, she appealed the termination, and she was successful.
Was she ever compensated for her loss of earnings?
Pardon me?
Was she compensated for her loss?
Did she get her back pay?
She got her back pay, yes.
She got all of it, is that right?
Correct. When her position was reinstated, they did make her reinstated in her current position, and she received her back pay. However,
well, how was she discriminated against?
The discrimination in the adverse employment action was the decision to terminate her.
But she got all of her back pay, and she got her position back. How was she outed it?
If under Title VII, the only damages that she's allowed to collect was her back pay, then I agree with the court that she has been made whole. However, under Title VII, she's entitled to other compensation additional to her lost wages. She has emotional distress. She had to pay for counsel to appeal her ruling. She was off of work for a period of 4 months while this appeal went on.
But she got it all back.
No.
She got back her lost wages.
Right.
Correct.
What, does she want double wages?
Pardon me?
She wants other wages or what?
Well, in addition to the termination, there was other claims made by the plaintiff. A hostile work environment. The hostile work environment was dismissed because of the fact that the court, one of the decisions was, there was no adverse action.
Can we go, before we go to the hostile work environment, I just want to make sure what other damages she would have been entitled to other than back pay. You're saying she was never compensated for the attorney's fees to pay counsel when she had to appeal, correct?
Correct.
And she was never compensated for her emotional distress?
The emotional distress of being terminated.
And were there
correct.
Any other damages other than back pay? Because I understand only back pay was what she got. So we do have some other damages.
I agree with
and
that.
And was there anything else? We named two. Was there anything else? I just want to make sure we get that clear before you move to hostile.
I can't think of any other damages
all
that
right.
she sustained.
Go ahead.
The problem with the district court's ruling regarding the adverse employment action, the court concluded that once she was reinstated, that the adverse employment action, the decision to terminate her, was wiped out. It's completely gone. If the purpose of Title VII is to eradicate discrimination, then the district court's ruling goes against that purpose. If someone is terminated because of their age or their race or whatever the reason is, and the employer comes in and said, I'm terminating you because of your age. And that individual employee does something about it. They mitigate their damages as they're required to do. The district court's opinion says, okay, if you reinstate it, if you realize that you did something wrong, then that adverse employment decision is gone. It's erased. What is a discriminatory act? It is the decision to terminate. The actual termination is almost irrelevant. It's what was the employer thinking when they made the decision to terminate. And you cannot erase that by reinstating someone. And in this case, the county didn't voluntarily reinstate. The only reason there was a reinstatement is because the appeal was done by the plaintiff, and the judge made a decision and ruled that, in fact, yes, the termination was improper, and county, you are required to reinstate her.
Now, how do you respond to the district court's reasoning that Phelan requested the transfer and that the hospital would have fired her anyway because she was absent for 54 consecutive days?
She requested a transfer because she was involved in a hostile environment. Transfer that they did was they moved her from one building on the campus to another building on the campus. Transfer is separate and distinct from the termination. The termination, and one of the reasons the district court gave was that we couldn't establish, the reason why he struck the gender discrimination, race discrimination, retaliation, was we couldn't meet the element that she was satisfactorily meeting the employer's work performance because of the fact that she was absent for 58 days. She was absent for 58 days from August to October because she was on medical leave because of the conduct that she was experiencing at Cook County Hospital. And the district court acknowledges that. The district court acknowledged that she requested medical leave because of the conduct. The appeal on the termination was reversed because of the fact was that she should have been granted the medical leave. So the fact that she was off for 58 days was concluded in her favor in that she should have been off on that time period because of the medical request that was improperly denied. The cases that are cited by counsel in connection with the adverse employment action are not involving a termination. The Seventh Circuit has never held that if there is a termination and somehow that termination is reinstated or wiped out for whatever reason, that there is no adverse employment action. And I think if that is allowed to stand, if an adverse employment action is able to be eradicated or eliminated because of a reinstatement, because someone takes their mitigation responsibilities to heart and actually does something about it, is an improper decision for this circuit to hold. And it affects how the district court dismissed the hostile work environment case. Court dismissed the hostile work environment case because he concluded there was no adverse employment action. Well, the no adverse employment action goes to whether or not an Ehlers defense is available. Since there was allegations and evidence to establish that supervisors had engaged in the improper and discriminatory conduct, that ruling by saying that there was no adverse employment action gives the Ehlers defense, which is contrary to what the Supreme Court was saying. They said the Ehlers defense is available to a hostile work environment case if the supervisor was the harasser. If there was no tangible employment action, then yes, the defense is available. The district court's ruling, in effect, gave the defendants this defense when it wasn't proper. To allow the district court's ruling to stand is to going against the ruling by the United States Supreme Court in Ehlers. The affirmative defense was not available in this situation because there was a supervisor who was doing the harassment, and there was a tangible employment action. There was a termination. The other reason why the court dismissed the sexual harassment or hostile work environment was because the court concluded that the claim of sexual harassment at the core center, which was her location after the transfer, the county was not on sufficient notice. And the district court then goes into a reasoning saying that although she made complaints and although harassment was done in the presence of other supervisors, she didn't make a formal complaint. And the court's opinion never really describes what they mean by a formal complaint. But it's my contention that he's holding the plaintiff to a higher standard. A complaint is a complaint. There is no requirement that it be a formal complaint, a complaint in writing.
Well, isn't that
there a requirement that she file one in writing?
No, not under the law. There is not.
I mean at the hospital.
She never received a sexual harassment policy, and the district court concluded this. Although there is evidence that there was a sexual harassment policy, there is evidence that she never received it. It was never disseminated to her. It was never posted within the facility. She did not know whether or not the sexual harassment requirement policy of the county required a written complaint. There's no evidence to suggest that that's even a requirement under the policy. But going back to this formal complaint requirement, if it is a supervisor who is doing the harassment, under the Ehlers decision, the county has vicarious liability. It's irrelevant whether or not there was a complaint made or not. That just goes to the defense, not as to whether or not the harassment occurred, and not whether or not she was subjected to a hostile work environment. As to co-employee, because there was also allegations and evidence to support that she was being harassed by co-employees, the question is whether or not the county knew or should have known. That's the standard, not a formal complaint standard. And because there was evidence to establish that this conduct was done in the presence of other supervisors, and that complaints, although verbal, were made to the Human Resource Department. Obviously, the county is not in a position to argue that they did not know or should have known of the complaint, of the harassment. The prima facie case was established by the evidence as to the hostile work environment. The district court's rulings for dismissing that count are insufficient. As to the gender discrimination, this kind of goes to your question, Your Honor. The court said there was two reasons why the gender discrimination count could not stand and not go before a jury. One was that she wasn't performing her job to the satisfaction of her employer because of this 58-day absence. The 58-day absence was because of the fact that she was on medical leave.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Pardon me?
You're into your rebuttal time.
Then I will stop. There's no further questions at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Sandberg.
May it please the court, Your Honors, counsel, to address a couple of things that counsel just raised. He talks about Title VII in the context of having to mitigate damages, but it's the defendant's contention that when Ms. Phelan was utilizing the collective bargaining agreement and the four-step process that was there, the pre-disciplinary hearing at which time she offered no testimony about why she wasn't there for the 58 days, she was represented by counsel. She certainly could have talked about what the reason for that was. After that pre-disciplinary hearing, what resulted would be a non-final termination decision by the county. The step two, the pre-disciplinary hearing, at which time she had waived union representation and chose to get her own attorney, that's the same thing that she did when she appealed with the four-step. And it was that four-step when the decision of the county was overturned. But until that decision from the independent hearing took place, there was no final determination, and as such, there was no tangible employment action against the plaintiff. This is a situation where all the mechanisms that were put into place by the county worked, and the mechanisms that were put into place by the collective bargaining agreement worked. And Ms. Phelan was a member of the union of which that collective bargaining agreement was applicable. So I respectfully disagree with counsel's representation that this is a mitigation of damages issue, because we weren't yet at that spot. Had the independent hearing affirmed the second step in the termination, then she would have had an obligation to mitigate damage.
Well, is it your position that the reinstatement wholly cured the hospital's adverse employment action?
It is that the reinstatement, prior to the reinstatement of that, there was no tangible employment action. There was no final decision. There can be no final decision pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement until she has exhausted her steps or has chosen not to go any further. And so she took it all the way to the fourth step, at which time the independent, Timothy Egan was the independent hearing officer, overturned the decision of the county. So it's the defendant's contention that there was never a final and tangible employment action.
So therefore, she shouldn't be able to present evidence that she was entitled to some of these other damages besides back pay for that four-month period. Is that your position?
It's the position that because there was no tangible employment action, there was no adverse employment action. So the fact that the hearing officer reinstated her to the same spot she was before, she wasn't working at the time, and so I forget the language of the exact order, but it was something to the effect of reinstating her health benefits and putting her
back in the spot. So if she was not terminated, then why wasn't she getting her salary?
Because she wasn't going to work. She was taking a leave for health reasons, according to her testimony. So,
and the health reasons were because of the harassment situation, which she had put the hospital on notice of.
While she was employed at the powerhouse, the county was aware of that situation and remedied it by transferring her to the core center, which counsel indicated that it's in the general vicinity of the hospital complex. However, they're two entirely independent entities. The boiler room at the powerhouse is just what it is described as. It's a big mechanical facility as opposed to the core center, which is a much newer facility and doesn't require the upkeep that the powerhouse did. So there are two distinct localities, and with the exception of her supervisor's supervisor, in this case Mr. Callahan, there was no dependence between the two of them. But going back to your question, Your Honor, about whether or not the county, I think your question was whether or not the county was aware of any concerns about harassing behaviors at the core center. Is that correct? That was your...
Right.
There is testimony from Ms. Phelan that she says that she told people, but as Your Honor's alluded to in the opening argument here, there was a formal process which she had already availed herself to, which resulted in the transfer to the core center, and so she was aware that there was a formal grievance, a written grievance that was required by the county. So her contention that simply mentioning this, which the defendants don't say that they were aware of these allegations, I think kind of belies the fact that...
Are you saying that she did admit that she knew there was a formal complaint procedure?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. What I am suggesting, though, is that having gotten the result that she... The transfer was what she wanted in the initial transfer from the powerhouse. And she became, through that process, aware of any of the grievance processes that she otherwise claimed she was unaware of by her having testified that I never got the policy, I never got the handbooks, things like that. So once the transfer to the core center took place, and if there were other instances of harassing behaviors that she is alleging, then she would have then already been aware that there's a specific policy that's in place, and she can go to her supervisor.
She was transferred. She became aware at that time.
There
is a policy.
Certainly. The defendants certainly would contend that, because the process worked exactly as it's supposed to when she got out of the powerhouse. When there are the alleged harassing behaviors by more than just one person, so it wasn't a matter of we could either move Ms. Phelan or somebody else, and she wanted a transfer, she wanted out of that, and there's some suggestions in the brief that she may be contending that this is a not appropriate transfer because it's not exactly where she wanted to go. I think she wanted to go to Oak Forest Hospital. However, it got her out of the situation that was what was causing her concern were the harassing behaviors.
But looking at sort of fact, the standards that we have to apply here, particularly when we're on summary judgment, she could survive summary judgment if she produced sufficient evidence that her race or gender and the actions of the hospital were impermissible motivating factors. In other words, it doesn't have to be the sole factor, the discrimination, but a motivating factor. Isn't there enough here in the record to allow it to go to a jury?
Is your question, Your Honor, whether or not the comments and things like that were sufficient to demonstrate that they may have been the catalyst for the transfer?
Right.
Not at all. I think to address the comments that are being made in the alleged harassing behaviors, I'm not sure that any of them can be suggested to be anything other than boorish behavior or...
Well, didn't those comments continue once she was transferred? She alleges that, Callahan swore at her and Giles and Partee threatened to fire her if she continued to complain about the harassment.
I believe you're accurate in that there's the suggestion that after they remedied all the problems at the powerhouse, that she's contending that now there are new things that are occurring at the core center. But then that goes back to the issue of whether or not not just the supervisor, Callahan, in this particular case, but the county and the people who should know and the people who are responsible for looking into these harassing complaints were advised, properly advised, pursuant to the policies that she became aware of. Does that answer your...
Yes.
Briefly, if I can, one of the first issues that we raised in our brief was the timeliness of these complaints in light of the way that the EEOC charge was styled. The EEOC charge in this case is particularized to a great extent and tracks virtually identically the language of the complaint. And in this case, they particularized the location as being that of the powerhouse at Cook County Hospital, the boiler room in the powerhouse. And because of that, once that right to sue letter goes to her counsel at that time, the only thing that can be raised in the district court would be those things that are asserted or alleged in that charge.
But you didn't challenge the adequacy of the EEOC complaint at the district court level, did you? Or maybe I misread the record.
I agree that in the summary judgment it wasn't challenged. It was raised as an affirmative defense to their complaint. So they're put on notice that there was concern about the timeliness of the filing. Although we're raising it as one of our primary arguments in this case, it has been developed and it was raised in the district court. The fact that the plaintiff in this case didn't try to rebut it once it was raised as an affirmative defense, I think is immaterial to whether or not there's a contention that it was properly raised.
And the court never addressed that point in the summary judgment motion.
The court never addressed that because it wasn't raised as part of the motions and the briefings of the summary judgment motion. So I would agree with that. And with the language of the EEOC charge setting out what's going to be alleged in the complaint and what's being alleged in the 1983 action, it would be the contention that all of those occurrences that are alleged as having occurred in the powerhouse, when she's transferred, that transfer date becomes the operative date to try to suggest whether or not there's a timely filing of the EEOC charge within 300 days. And in this case, with that being the benchmark, that wasn't done. And as far as the suggestion in our brief that the timeliness of the 1983 cause of action, which has a 2-year statute of limitations, the only date-specific allegations that have come forth in discovery is whether or not the would have been the alleged assault and battery actions. Those would be the only ones that would have fallen within that 2-year period from the time of the filing of the complaint. As to a number of the discrimination allegations, another thing that the plaintiff has failed to demonstrate is similarly situated individuals having received treatment different than that. In this case, there's nothing in the record to suggest that there's someone who, I guess we got to focus on the termination, somebody who, having failed to go to work for 58 days, whether or not a male who, having failed to go to work for 58 days, somehow was treated differently.
Now, just in terms of this 58-day period, her lawyer notified the hospital in June 20th, about the sexual harassment. And then she called in the next month, and that's when she took off sick because of the harassment. Isn't that right? I just want to make sure I have the timing correct. And then she applied for medical leave the next month.
Correct, and the medical leave was denied. I believe that that's what the record says, is that medical leave was denied, and so just on her own, she ends up taking the time off.
And then the date of termination was actually October 12th.
That's correct. Once the hearing takes place, I think the actual date that they end up going back to is the date that it may be the immediately following day to when they had sent the letter scheduling that pre-disciplinary hearing.
And then the back pay that she received was for that period from October 12th to February 9th?
Your Honor, I'm not sure exactly what back pay dating, as far as the bracketing of when that back pay would have been received was. But again, it's our contention that there was no adverse employment action. This is a situation that everything worked as it's supposed to happen. Once there was the allegations of harassment, the county got on it, did everything they needed to do and to investigate it, and once that investigation was completed, they transferred to the core center. In this case, this is not just a let's move Ms. Phelan over to the core center. In the county system, there are slots that exist, and so they had to remove her slot from the powerhouse and move it over to the core center. So it's not just kind of substituting, let's kind of shuffle over here. There are jobs available in certain locations. And so they, when they realized that there was nothing else available, they went to that extra step of actually moving everything about her over to the core center. I see my time is up. If the court has no further questions, I'll conclude. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Holman.
Thank you. And if I can just address the timeliness question. The distinction they're trying to make is her transfer to the core center. The charge of discrimination and the complaint didn't make a distinction between the time she worked at the powerhouse and the core center because, in essence, it's irrelevant. She worked at the Buildings and Grounds Department of Cook County Hospital from the day she started till the day she was terminated, period. Her supervisor was Callahan from the day she started till the day she was terminated. They want to make a big issue that we didn't plead in the charge of discrimination about the core center transfer. It's virtually irrelevant that she was transferred to the core center. It's a separate building on the campus. She never changed positions. She was mechanical assistant the entire time. There is virtually no distinction. What the charge alleges and what the complaint alleges is that the discriminatory conduct occurred from April of 1999 till her termination of October of 2000. Counsel suggested to this court that she wasn't terminated on October 11, 2000 when the decision came down to terminate her because she was a member of a collective bargaining agreement and she was able to appeal it. Had she done nothing, which was her right, she was terminated on October 11, 2000, period. Her pay stopped. She wasn't allowed on the campus. She was not an employee at that time. The fact that the collective bargaining agreement allowed her to do an appeal and the fact that Ms. Phelan took on that responsibility and said, I will hire counsel and take that step approach, is what she did. Because she is a member of a union does not mean that she's not entitled to her rights or seek redemption under Title VII or Section 1983.
Because your position is her salary stopped at that point, so it was final.
Correct. And she could have walked away at that point. And if that were the case, they'd be arguing that she failed to mitigate her damages. And that goes back to where my point is, where the adverse employment action occurred, and you can't wipe it out because she was reinstated. It's just not proper. The transfer to the core center was not what she wanted. She wanted a transfer to a different Cook County facility. That's what she wanted. The hostile work environment was Cook County Hospital. Whether it's building A, B, C, the powerhouse, the core center, she wasn't removed from that hostile environment because she was moved across the campus. The people who were harassing her still had access to the core center. Her supervisor, who did nothing to stop the harassment, other than going to the Human Resource Department, said, I need help. I don't know what to do. I can't control these men. And when the Human Resource Department said, why don't we do some sexual harassment training for the men in your department? Mr. Callahan's response was, it won't do any good. These guys are old school. And Ms. Kelly's understanding of that was, old school meant that times when women weren't respected by men. What did Callahan do after that? Told Ms. Phelan, don't go back to Human Resources. Don't make complaints. As to counsel's suggestion that she understood the formal complaint procedure because she complained and the transfer occurred and the system works, when she complained to the Human Resource Department, she put nothing in writing. She went there to Ms. Kelly and made a verbal complaint. And according to them, the system worked because she was transferred to another location where the hostile environment continued. This was a ruling on summary judgment. The evidence, the record is clear that there's sufficient evidence to allow this case to go to a jury, and the district court's decision cannot stand. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. This case will also be taken under advisement. We'll